Welcome back to Film Chat. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Ash Connaughton, DP, award-winning DP at that. Worked with many clients such as NHS, Channel 4, BBC, Warner Brothers, and many, many more. And if you're from the Birmingham scene, you may have seen him at local festivals as I did. Ash, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was great to meet you at Wolverhampton, which is a really lovely local festival. The team there are just so passionate about the region and creativity and film within the Midlands. So it's a really lovely environment to get out and meet people. It was lovely to meet yourself and be here today.
Yeah, man, it's great what festivals can do. You know, it's so good for networking as well as getting your films out there. But local festivals like Wolverhampton, you know, not the biggest, it's still very early days, but each year getting bigger, yeah. and taking the right steps.
4 years now, I think they've been going. I think 4 years, and they've grown massively every single year. So, and like I said, it's a really lovely team of people there. So, you know, fingers crossed they continue to grow and continue to be a force for good in the industry in the region.
Yeah, man, fingers crossed. Well, Ash, as I mentioned, award-winning DP. I've not had a DP on before, so it's my first time interviewing a DP.
Wow.
Yeah, so I guess it's
a pretty low bar then, which is good. I haven't got to live up to someone like Roger Deakins doing an interview on there.
Yeah, man, you're setting the pace now for DPs in the future. starting off, I guess, how would you like to introduce yourself as well? I gave you an introduction, but how would you describe yourself as a filmmaker?
I think you did a fantastic job of introing me, but I think for me personally, like the way I would describe myself as a DP and filmmaker is my big passion really is narrative storytelling. I think that's the reason a lot of people get into the job. It's a love of storytelling. It's a love of creating. And I work across a real variety of stuff. I do everything from TV doc through to narrative with a couple of music videos thrown into the mix, and then like a ton of branded and commercial stuff, because that's always good fun and decent earners, and good bread and butter to have, you know. But the big passion is narrative and storytelling and delving into character and what makes people tick, you know.
Yeah. That's great, man. I'd love to touch on the stories that attract you. But before that, why the role of a DP? What led you down this path specifically?
So, I mean, I left school not really knowing what I wanted to do. I'd always been quite creative, but never really had what I would describe as creative skills. Like, I can't paint, I can't draw, can't play a musical instrument, nothing like that. But I'd always been a really visual person and very visually motivated. And I went to college and studied media. And through that, made my first short film. And originally thought I wanted to be a director, because I liked the level of creative input and the being able to guide something from start to finish. But then very quickly through doing that process of making my first short, I realized the thing that I was the most interested in was the visual side. And at that point in my life, I didn't really know what a DOP was. Yeah. So it never really occurred to me that there was this role that was this blend between artist and technician, that had such a strong input and ability to guide the visuals of something. So really kind of fell in love with cinematography, and then spent a number of years working up for a camera department. Again, across various stuff from documentaries to commercials to narrative, doing some like high-end TV drama as an assistant as well. And then eventually started shooting more and more of my own stuff and building up a showreel. And then I've been a DP full-time now for seven, eight years. So.
Wow. Fair, man. That's a very well put, I guess. In terms of the early days then, working through camera departments and trying to find your flow in that space. What was that like?
I think starting those first few jobs as a camera trainee, there's a very steep learning curve. Everything in camera is a process. there is procedure, there is process to pretty much everything you do, whether that's building the camera, reloading, slating. It is all a series of processes. So there's a steep learning curve to that. And then there's a lot of attention to detail for quite minor, seemingly minor things like battery management and just management of equipment and logistics, and all of that kind of falls on camera department. And you have to become very good at that stuff in a very short amount of time. So there's there's a very steep learning curve to it. And it's, you know, it's a very technical role. Like, working in camera department, unless you're operating, isn't really a creative role. As crazy as that might sound to people who perhaps don't know, it's a logistics, it's a it's a lot of lumping kit around, it's a lot of problem solving and troubleshooting, and then a lot of following procedure. So there's not tons of creativity that goes into camera department sometimes. Real learning curve, steep learning curve there. But obviously, I think it's very important that people do their time in camera. Mm. Like, if someone wants to be a cinematographer, the three things you really need to understand, if we're stripping it down to its base elements, is what the camera team does and how to manage and run that and support that team. What the lighting team does, and again, how to manage and support that, but also how to light and how to paint creatively and understanding how light works. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing I would say is understanding character and story. And I think that translates across the board, whether it's a narrative piece or a commercial, because ultimately every piece of content is a form of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And understanding character. So whether that's the main character in a film, or the person that we follow in a commercial, or someone in a branded or corporate video, it's understanding what the core of that character is, what motivates them, what their purpose is, and how they fit into the narrative. So I'd say that those are probably the three quite condensed big things that people should try to understand and learn.
Yeah, I think you perfectly kind of put it into two ways. There's this sort of nuts and bolts aspect of just the technical expertise and understanding rigs and working with the lighting department, for example. And then there's the understanding the character. Now, on a narrative project, how do you personally go about understanding the character? Is it speaking to the director/writer, or is it, you know, how is that collaboration?
Yeah, so it's a number of things. And I mean, really, you know, I think any good DP knows that a project is made in prep. Mm. If you fail to prepare, you're preparing to fail. And that can look like a lot of things. And everyone I've spoken to preps slightly differently. When it comes to directors, some love shot lists, some love storyboards, some like to be a little more loose with it and try and find things on the day. And I think another important skill to have as a DP is to be adaptable to that, because ultimately your part of your job is to bring the director's vision to life and input into it and grow it and develop it. So I think you've really got to be in tune with how the director you're working with likes to prep. If somebody's very, very storyboard heavy, then I have to pivot to that. And maybe I'll do my own shot list for my own clarity. Like, for me, prep tends to look like a shot list, a lighting plan, and then some visual references. Those tend to be like the bare minimum that I always do. But then it kind of depends on what the director wants and what helps them. Because for some projects I've done, some directors have been very big on previs. So that's so previs is a relatively new thing on the independent scene. It's been done in high end for years, but it's become, like many things, cheaper and more accessible. And previs can sometimes be a hand-drawn storyboard, or it can be a 3D rendered thing done in something like Unreal Engine, which is free software, which is incredible. And I think it's just kind of dependent on how the director likes to prep and what's going to help them visualize and understand and be able to see it and help me see what they're seeing. And sometimes a shot list does that, sometimes a storyboard does that, sometimes you sort of need to get into the nitty-gritty of previs and be talking about it on a much more technical level. And it sort of depends on the shot and the style of shoot as well. You know, I mean, two people sat in a room having a conversation is intrinsically always going to be slightly more simple than a big car chase of explosions, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But like
usually, you mentioned, anyway.
Yeah, usually. So like you mentioned, it's all in the prep, it's all in the planning, it's in those discussions and you know, like you mentioned, you have that initially rather than on the shoot. On the shoot, it should be in
yeah. If you're making those decisions on the shoot, it is too late.
You
know, but in terms of like that was the more like technical side of prep. In terms of like, because you asked about understanding character, how do I do that? Mm-hmm. And that often that comes from A, me reading the script many, many, many times to really just ingest it and understand it and try and visualize it. But then also talking to the director and maybe the writer and maybe the actor. You know, sometimes there's been situations where there's been a three-way conversation between me, a director, and an actor, all kind of just getting into the nitty-gritty of who this character is. And that can really inform visuals sometimes. Of course, it depends on the project massively. And there's not always the time in prep, especially on lower budget things, to have those in-depth conversations with anyone but the director. But the more time I can spend with them getting in their head and talking and bouncing ideas and just asking questions, you know, what does this scene mean to you? How does this person feel in this moment? What are they trying to achieve in this conversation? You know, all of that can inform, it can inform camera movement, it can inform lighting, and just help to build up that picture of how you shoot the thing.
Yeah. Are there ever, and I'm sure there probably are, so conflicts between a director's, you know, idea of how they viewed that story when they, you know, had it, and then for you as a DP come in, what's possible? What does this look like to you, for example, as well? And how do you resolve that?
So yeah, I mean, there's always going to be difference of opinion. There's always going to be conflict. But I think, firstly, it's building that relationship. So being in a place where you and the director both have that deep intrinsic understanding of the narrative, of the characters, and of everything you're trying to achieve on the shoot, I think is crucial. But there's always going to be differences in opinion, and there's always going to be different ideas, and maybe, you know, especially in the moment, quite often sometimes there'll be something on the day that we'll see and go, oh, why don't we try it this way instead? Because sometimes what you've got planned, it doesn't work for whatever reason, or it's not quite playing how you hoped it would. And then, you know, someone comes up with something on the day and says, oh, why don't we try this? And then it works 10 times better than anything you could have ever envisioned. But in terms of managing like the disagreements, I think there's a little bit of choosing your battles. And it really depends on your relationship with the director. I mean, some directors I'm very close with, we're good personal friends, and we can have very honest, frank conversations about something. And I can be like, you know, I disagree because of X, Y, Z. And then sometimes the director will then come back with, oh, well, it needs to be this way because of X, Y, Z. And it's like a two-way conversation. It's, you know, explain to me why it needs to be that specific way, and we make it work. And then other times it'll be, I'll make a suggestion and they'll go, oh, actually, yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, or I hadn't considered that. Let's do it. And I think it comes down to being willing to collaborate and shift and adapt. And I think the best directors are collaborators at heart. You know, that they allow space for ideas and for people to feed into things.
Yeah, I feel those are the best. I mean, it's necessary to do well with the film, because it's such a collaborative effort, not just with the DP, but with everybody on set. So, you know, a director that leaves their ego at the door and is ready to take on suggestions, that makes the project overall better, I believe. As an extension of that point you made about compromising, with you yourself, do you think that you have a signature sort of style, or a signature sort of way to present a film, or do you come on to the project and adapt fully? Obviously, there must be a sort of spectrum with that, with how much you adapt or how much you bring, right? But what do you think are the sort of core tenets that you feel you bring as a DP?
So I don't think I wouldn't say I have a particular style. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that you could look at my projects and go, that's his style. Maybe mm-hmm. there is something like that. I'm not sure. But for me, I think everything I've shot, I mean, if we're talking about narrative specifically, everything I've shot is so different. There's mm-hmm. quite a wide variety of projects of different genres and different visual styles. And I think I try to bring that adaptability and that flexibility and that the cinematography should serve the narrative and it should feel appropriate to the story you're trying to tell and not draw too much attention to itself. Mm-hmm. I think it should almost be invisible. And that's not to say you can't do standout shots that make people go, oh, wow, that was a really good shot. But I think generally it needs to feel more invisible and more just in service to the story and the characters. And I would say that's something I try to do stylistically, is just constantly adapting and constantly looking at the story and going, right, how do we shoot this in a way that feels A, appropriate, and B, in service to and building upon what the narrative is?
Yeah. That's a healthy way to do it. Then I guess adapting to this story and being a part of propelling that idea. Then that takes me back to an earlier question or earlier point we made. We kind of sidetracked it, but what are then the initial ideas or the initial stories from a narrative perspective that attract you to a project? What stories are you looking to tell?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting one. I mean, on a personal level, I'm a massive fan of science fiction. I'm a massive fan of military drama. Those are two genres that subgenres that I really enjoy on a personal level. But in terms of what attracts me to a project, it's initially the script, the logline, the characters. If I think it's trying to do something different or interesting or has an interesting vibe, it can be a million things that make me go, yes, this is a project I want to undertake. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can be purely the director or someone who's attached to it, like the producer or talent or a mixture of all those things, you know? And I think the thing is, like, really, really early doors in your career, you want to be shooting not absolutely everything, but as much as you can. Just mm-hmm. getting out there, learning, making mistakes mm-hmm. is so valuable early on because you'll quite often realize, I'm not going to do that again. And whether that be lighting something in a particular way or shooting something in a particular way or that style of project, you learn through doing and through experimentation, and you learn what you do and you don't like. Mm-hmm. So I think, advice for people early on is get out and shoot as much as you can. Mm-hmm. But then there will become a time where you then need to become a little bit more choosy and go, what does this project do for me? And what can I do for it? And do the two line up in a way that's interesting and is worthwhile.
Yeah, I was going to ask that as well, in terms of with time now becoming more experienced and now, like you mentioned, choosing projects. And I think you put it very well. It's not just about what can the project do for me. It's about, what can I actually do for this project? Because now you have more semblance over this is what I can bring to the table. And I think that's really good. I think then, how is it different than looking for work early days, not to the camera partner, but like as a DP, looking for work early days, and now at this point in time, choosing projects. What's that timeline been like? What's it been like?
Yeah. So, I mean, very early on, I turned down very little. If an opportunity came my way, it was like, yep, take it, learn from it, even if I'm not in love with the script or the story or mm-hmm. whatever it is, it will be a worthwhile experience. Now it's more, perhaps two or three films come along that are all a little similar, and that's not to say they're the same or not to say it's the same idea or not worthwhile doing, but there'll be like a consistent vibe between certain projects. And then it's looking at who's attached to it, what's the budget? You know, I'm very much at the stage where I don't want to be doing stuff where there isn't the money to bring in a team. And by that, I don't just mean a camera team. I mean production design. I mean, you know, a proper post team. I want to be doing stuff that the people are doing a proper job of. Not to devalue the smaller indie stuff where it's a skeleton crew and they're just trying to make something, because I think there is so much value to those kind of projects, especially for people early on, because I think it's always much better to just get out and make something than be sat waiting for that 10, 20, 30, 40 grand to do your short, you know?
Yeah.
Get out and make stuff is the best thing you can do. But I'm at that stage now where I'm wanting to do stuff that can bring on a team and can have those multiple creative energies all bringing their best to it, because that's what I think, you know, that levels up a project and sets it apart. And obviously we're talking on a very like independent narrative focus here. You know, the larger scale stuff is very different because that team is just in place and just will be in place. Mm-hmm. But when you're trying to make a short film for, you know, a limited budget, it's always toss-ups between what's actually going to bring value to the final output and make it as good as we can for as little money as we can, you know?
Yeah. And I think in addition to that, an earlier point you made about do it, like you mentioned, doing as much work as possible early doors is about making as many mistakes as possible early doors.
Absolutely.
Because that also teaches you, but it also teaches you what you're good at as well, what you like about what sort of projects you like as well. So as you do more and more projects, more variety, then you'll be able to tailor it down, not because just because of expertise, but also because of your own preferences as well. And that's a great sort of line to go down as well. Award-winning DP. I want to talk a little bit about festivals. What are you like with festivals? You know, your films have gone to many different festivals, different places as well. Do you try to go to them and attend them, and what is the festival experience like for yourself when your movie's screening?
So it's always lovely to see something you've shot screen in front of an audience. And by an audience, I don't just mean the cast and crew screening, because those are always lovely. And it's nice to get back together with the team that made it and enjoy that moment. But it's something really special to see something with an audience who are seeing it for the first time and have no relation to it. You know, pure audience is always a really, really great experience. And to see how people react, you know, are they laughing where you hope they will? Are they crying if you want them to? You know, are people having that reaction that you were trying to sort of create and that vibe? But yeah, festivals generally I do try and attend when I've got stuff screening as often as I can, but obviously it depends on work. If I'm on another project on those dates, can't do it. I mean, there was a premiere that I went to last year for the Hammer documentary I shot that was at the Cineworld in Leicester Square in London. I was shooting a feature film the day that premiere was happening. So me and my camera assistant, who also worked on the doc, we wrapped filming that day at about 6 p.m. And then I drove us to London and we went to the premiere. And we didn't get back till about 3 in the morning. And then we were on set the next day at 7:30. So
yeah,
it was a long old day, and wouldn't recommend doing that all the time. But once in a blue moon to be at something like that, it was worth the lack of sleep and the, you know, the long day.
Yeah,
I try and attend festivals as often as I can, because like you said earlier, they're a fantastic way to network and meet people. And it's good to be present and representing something that you've been involved in and being seen to be involved in stuff, you know, and to be actually out there in the real world, meeting people and engaging, and you know, they're such a worthwhile thing. But I mean, the festival game is a bit of a minefield. And I think for filmmakers, it's about figuring out which festivals are worth targeting. Because I think, you know, smaller independent ones quite often are great for laurels and great for adding, you know, festival nominations to a poster. But do the awards from those independent festivals carry the same weight as a nomination or award from something that's BIFFA or BAFTA qualifying? Not really, you know? So the, it's sort of this tiered thing about the value of what you get. And the thing is, any recognition is fantastic. And I think, you know, there's some fantastic films out there that, that deserve so much recognition, both on the smaller festival circuit and on the larger circuit. And I think it's just for filmmakers to figure out where their film's best going to sit.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
It's a complicated game.
It's a very complicated game. And, you know, I've spoken about submitting films to festivals with many filmmakers, and, you know, sometimes it's so strange, you know, that you might, a bigger festival may accept your film while a smaller festival doesn't. And then that just comes down to taste or whoever was on the panel that viewed it. And that, you know,
and what's been programmed already, you know, and sometimes it can come down to length. If your film's just slightly too long for them to fit in their program, they're going to go, oh, that's an easy no for us, you know? So it's crazy how complicated it can be, and how, like you said, a bigger festival can accept it, and then a small little local indie one that you think's a shoe in just goes, no, we're okay. It's you just can't predict it. You really can't.
Yeah, so it's important not to take it to heart, I guess, then.
Yeah.
But when the good moments happen, the awards, Ash, what's that like receiving an award? And an extension of that is, you know, when you make films, you know, like you mentioned, you're passionate about filmmaking. So when you win an award, is that a sort of validation for yourself, or is the film itself the validation for you?
I think, for me personally, like, the biggest validation, and you don't do it for the validation, but the biggest validation comes from audience reaction. For me personally, it's seeing how an audience reacts to something. That's the magic of it. And that's certainly why I do it. It's to tell stories that resonate with people and have some level of impact, you know. We're not saving lives, but it's, I think, you know, the arts are important, and people can get a lot from film and storytelling on the whole. You know, the awards are great. Winning an award's fantastic. And it feels amazing to get recognition on any sort of level for the time, effort, and work you've put in something. You know, I won my first award for cinematography earlier this year at a small independent local festival. And it was a really lovely moment, because it was a film that I'm incredibly proud of. It's a film that I made with some very dear friends. We made it for very little money. It was a very scrappy production, but punches so far above its weight. So it was nice to win for that, and it has won a number of awards at other festivals, and he's doing really well. It's only just begun its festival circuit, like, a couple of months ago.
What film is that? Really.
That's Daniel's Room.
Okay.
And that's a short horror film, psychological horror, and a real sort of character study of the main character, Emily. And it just came back from us wanting to make something wanting to make something that punched well above its weight.
Yeah.
You know, the total budget was less than 5,000 British pounds.
Wow.
So, and it's a sub 15 minute short. But everyone that's seen it is like, wow, this looks like it was made for so much more money than you guys had, which is a hell of a compliment and a testament to the hard work and passion and just dedication that everyone on that team brought to it.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's incredible to hear, and congrats on that win as well. That must be very nice. But like you, I think that's such a great thing that you mentioned, is that the validation may not be in that individual award itself. It's the experience of seeing people. And I think that's so important and beautiful, because, you know, even if you don't win an award, just seeing your film screened and being part of an audience there. And, you know, like you mentioned, if they laugh at the right moments, if they cry at the right moments, whatever the case is, just seeing that must
be the jump scare. Which the answer was yes.
Incredible. That's the real validation. A couple more questions, I guess, just about the industry as a whole and where mm-hmm. things are shifting, as well as your experience. You mentioned Unreal Engine and new technologies that are looming yeah. over us. I want your opinion, Ash, on AI. I mean, the dreaded conversation, the dreaded topic for some people. What's your thoughts on it?
So I'd firstly like to touch on Unreal Engine, separate to the AI conversation. So Unreal is, for those that don't know, it's a video game engine, and it's now used in film and TV for virtual production, which is basically, to simplify it, instead of green screen, you shoot the characters against a big LED screen that has a digital environment live in the background. So the idea is, as you move the camera, the environment shifts, so the perspective change. And it's most famously been used on The Mandalorian as the big volume, which is a big LED screen that is, I think, not quite 360 degrees, but thereabouts. And it's got a ceiling that's projected as well. So you can build a 3D environment and place these characters in that environment in camera rather than it being a composite in post. Yeah. So it has, there's a lot of benefits to it, but it's obviously very expensive. It's very new technology. It's very cutting edge. But it is, again, becoming more accessible. I mean, there's a fantastic studio in Bristol called Distortion Studios who have an LED volume. And I shot a series of commercials there earlier this year for a trade supply company. And that was my first real sort of big attempt at virtual production. I'd done things on a much smaller scale before, but that was the first time we were doing like full body shots of somebody in an environment. And that was a really cool experience and sort of a real nice learning curve of how to light that, because you've obviously got control over the lighting in the 3D environment that's behind the subject, but then you need to match that lighting in the real world to make it feel seamless. So that was a lot of fun to figure that out and spend some time tweaking that and fine tuning and really getting that to those two environments to match up and look seamless. And I think we did a pretty good job of it. But yeah, to move on from Unreal, the AI question, I think we've very much opened Pandora's box with it. It's not going away. It's something that's here to stay. It's a technology that is going to keep changing and growing and adapting and becoming better. I think it has its uses. I think it can be a really great way to communicate ideas and pre-visualize and say, look, here's the general vibe of something. Do I think it should be used in final product that is then presented to an audience? No. Personally, no. I think leave art to people, you know?
Yeah.
Leave it to the people that have got the technical expertise, that have got the creative vision, that have put the blood, sweat and tears into it and are striving to create something for people, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think, like I said, it's a useful tool and I think it definitely has its uses, and it's another way that art becomes more accessible to people, but there's a reason that art related skills are skills.
Art's about portraying emotion and feeling and resonating with an audience, and no AI language model or whatever can experience that yet.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the technology has come on an incredibly long way in an incredibly short time. You know, I mean, if you look at AI generated video now versus 12 months ago versus 3 years ago, the difference is incredible. The things you can do with it are incredible. And I've worked on projects that have used AI. I did a documentary a couple of years ago about Gerry Anderson, who was the creator of things like Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet. And this was in association with ITV. And we used an AI model to take a photo of Gerry Anderson and then deep fake his face onto an actor who then performed based on audio recordings that Gerry made before he passed away with his biographer. So it was Gerry Anderson's words spoken by him that were brought to life by an actor and slash body double who was essentially performing alongside them. And through the combination of the authentic audio from Jerry himself and then the AI model that then brought his face on and replaced the actor's face, we essentially brought him back for an interview. And he passed away in 2012.
Wow.
So incredible use of this technology, and it was one of the first, you know, bigger documentaries to do something like that, which was really cool to be a part of. And I think that there's something there in using it in an ethical way. I think the use of AI ethically, we need to do a lot of work bringing things into law that make sure it's used in an ethical way, in a way that isn't going to cause harm. Because that's the thing with technology, you've got fantastic power to do good, but also can cause great harm, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of bad actors that can misuse it. And it's like you mentioned, it's so early in a sense, and it's so rapidly expanding that the lawmakers and policy, you know, legislators can't even keep up with how quick things are going. So I think it will take legal cases and you know, eventually people litigating to get to that stage where we get law, and that takes years and years and years. Yeah. So I guess it's
unfortunately some stuff's gonna have to go wrong, you know.
Yeah,
some stuff's gonna have to go wrong before law goes, right, maybe that's not a good way to use this technology.
Yeah, exactly that. So I guess it is on. Is a self-policing thing right now? It's calling stuff out, maybe when you work on projects, and if something's a bit grey, like, okay, let's not do that, you know, things like that. But unfortunately, it has to be self-policing until, like you mentioned, lawmakers finally get involved.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, stuff is happening in the background. There's been a lot of new AI-related law and proposals drafted over the past couple of years. I have friends that are working on that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's happening in the background, but change takes a long time and technology ultimately moves faster.
Yeah.
So they're going to be playing catch up for a long time. And then by the time we've got law that is applicable to the stuff we've got now, there's going to be new AI tech that's doing completely different stuff. And
yeah.
Like I said, it's Pandora's box and it's open. It's not going back in the box. We need to figure out how we make use of it in an ethical way. And make the best out of this new technology. You know, there is a worry it's going to affect certain styles of production, like pack shot commercials. There's a lot of worry that those are essentially going to go in the bin because they'd be relatively easy to AI generate, which I sort of agree with. But like I said earlier, I think leave art to people. Let people create and let AI crunch numbers or manage data or, you know, use it to inform stuff and help reduce workload and intensity. And there's also the environmental impact of it. I mean, you know, AI, the data centers use so much electricity. Like the carbon footprint from them is shocking. It's a tricky one. It's a tricky one.
It's very, like you meant, there's so much around AI. It's not just the usage itself. There's so much around it that people need to control a bit. But it's good that, you know, to be aware of it and talk about it. So I really appreciate your answer for that. About three more questions. One is just about your filmmaking. I want to ask you about a film that you've made or a shoot that was particularly challenging. Why was it challenging that you still think of it, and how did you guys face that?
Oh, right, specific example. So I think, God, every project I've ever done has had challenges, has had stuff happen in the moment that we've had to overcome. You know, perhaps something's not worked, or something's broken, or I mean, so on a recent short film, we had this souped up mobility scooter that was being used for a stunt. And it was the first day of production. We had 4 unit moves that one day, which is, it's a lot of unit moves. Anyone that knows they just burn time. And it was at the second location. We got there, the scooter just decided not to work, so they had to spend ages trying to fix it. I think they were trying to fix it for like 40 minutes. Got it back up and running, it was fine. But obviously, at that point, we're 40 minutes behind and have to make up that time somewhere. And then, you know, it was just one of those days where things were going wrong and taking longer and traffic on the unit moves. And we did end up wrapping late on that day, but it's, you know, it's independent short, you know, stuff happens. It's, but that was a particularly challenging one. And then we had some bad weather at the third location, and it just, everything that could have gone wrong that day went wrong. And you just kind of have to roll with the punches a little bit and go, right, I did have like perhaps an hour and a half scheduled for this thing. I've now got like 30 minutes. How do I make this work and still get everything we need? So it's a lot of thinking on your feet, a lot of problem solving, a lot of perhaps looking at what you've planned and going, right, do we actually need all this, or how can we make this work in a more streamlined way? Because we've got 30 minutes when we should have had three times that. So sometimes you have to compromise. And I think, again, that comes down to the director you're working with as well. You know, how willing to compromise are they? How good at problem solving are they? Because I've always said filmmaking is problem solving. Mm-hmm. That's like the number one thing you've got to do. No matter what role you're in, it's problem solving. All of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the unforeseen problems I guess the worst, the worst problems.
Or perhaps, you know, the foreseen problems that you go, right, well, I hope that doesn't go wrong.
Oh,
but if it does, it's just going to take time, you know? Mm. Like, we could have known that the mobility scooter was going to have problems because it was modified, you know? Mm. It was running this souped-up battery and the motor was, you know, it was a crazy, crazy thing they'd done. So knowing that, we sort of knew that was maybe going to go wrong.
Yeah.
And it did. So it's just kind of foreseeing that stuff and having a plan B in your back pocket that you can go, right, we pivot to this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. I guess that's what it's about. It's about pivoting. It's about pivoting, yeah. And I guess things like that get easier with experience. Get easier with when you know how to use time more efficiently. And like you mentioned, what's necessary, what isn't necessary.
That's the thing. Like once you've solved a problem once, you're probably gonna face it again and know how to solve it. You know. Like I said, the having 30 minutes versus an hour and a half, looking at the scene and going, right, what do we actually need shots-wise?
Hmm.
Like,
yeah,
that comes up all the time. You're always going to be behind. You're always going to be up against it. And that doesn't change as the budget level increases. And sometimes the answer is to throw some more money at it. Other times the answer is compromise. And it just kind of depends where you're at on that spectrum, you know?
Yeah. And knowing which path to take. Then about your own personal taste in films, what are some films that, you know, you adore the cinematography of?
Yeah. So, I mean, from a cinematography perspective, I think that's perhaps a slightly different answer to the films I love the most. Because I think, so my top five films of all time, it's quite a stereotypical list. I mean, for me, this is in no particular order, but Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back. I grew up with Star Wars, absolutely love it. The original Jurassic Park, again. So watching that as a kid, I think I went through a phase of wanting to be a paleontologist.
Yeah.
But what I actually realise, looking back on it, is I wanted to work in film.
Mm.
That's what, and that was one of those first films that I watched where I was acutely aware of how much had gone into making it.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of blew my mind and fascinated me. And really thinking about it, that's when I realized I wanted to work in film. The original Gladiator, I think is essentially the perfect film.
Mm-hmm.
Just flawless, in my opinion. I'm sure people will disagree, but I will die on that hill. Forrest Gump, because I think it's an incredibly heartfelt story and very versatile. And it's got a little bit of everything, you know? Mm-hmm. There's there's a sports hero story, there's a war movie, there's romance, there's all these different little bits of the patchwork quilt that is life. And I think it does a fantastic job of piecing together the character's life story. And then the curveball pick is We're the Millers.
Whoa. Okay.
It's a real sort of guilty pleasure. I think it's just a well-made silly comedy that always makes me laugh. I've watched it like numerous times over the years. It never fails to make me laugh. And I think, you know, it sets out to do stuff like to be funny and be silly. And I think it hits all the beats it needs to hit, and it does a great job of it, you know?
Yeah.
And I respect it for that.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough.
But cinematography-wise, it's not exactly a beautiful film, but I would say it's visually a very appropriate cinematography style for what it's trying to do.
Okay. It is quite a range there, thematically speaking. But yeah, okay. Wow. I didn't expect that, Ash, to be honest. I didn't expect that. But yeah, I love the answer nonetheless.
But if we want to talk purely visually, I mean... Okay. Anything Roger Deakins has ever shot, ever, just beautiful. Greg Fraser, fantastic work. Like Rogue One, The Creator, just he's got such a beautiful. I mean, the Batman was visually incredible. It almost felt like a noir film.
Mm-hmm.
Just some incredibly beautiful stuff.
Yeah. First, you have your favorite cinematographers, and then their films speak for themselves.
Traffic.
Yeah. Just a final question for me, Ash. Thank you so much for your time. Final question is, what advice would you give to an emerging filmmaker?
Okay, so filmmaker generally or cinematographer?
Let's do both.
Okay.
What one thing that applies to everyone, and then one thing that applies to just cinematography.
So anybody that wants to work in film, best piece of advice I can give you is network. Get out there and meet people. Whether that's over Instagram or in person, like get involved with local filmmaking events. So in Birmingham, there's a fantastic grassroots networking event called Real Brum. And that is a great way for people to get out and meet people. And the team behind that are fantastic. They also run the Forward Film Festival, which is an incredible independent film festival in Birmingham. And Daniel's Room did quite well there, I think. I think it won Best Midlands Short, and I think it was Best Makeup. I think. I could be wrong, so don't quote me on that. But yeah, so that was a great festival, which unfortunately I couldn't be at because I was I was on a job. I think I might have been in Turkey on a shoot, but I wasn't around, so I couldn't go, but we'll definitely be going next year because the team behind it are just wonderful people, and they really care, and it's really nice to have just such a film focused festival in Birmingham run by people that care and that are so involved in the local industry. Just really, really great vibes. So looking forward to that next year. But yeah, sorry, the advice is network. Get out and meet people, make stuff, even if it's like a, you know, 2 minute short with your friends. Mm-hmm. Just get out and make stuff and find the kind of stories you want to tell and your vision. And I would say, like, if you don't know what you want to do in film, try different roles. Like use those really small indie sets to experiment and try different job roles, and you might find something you really love.
Mm-hmm.
And then for cinematographers, I think that advice all still applies, but I think more so it's like experiment with lighting, experiment with camera. Don't be afraid to like try stuff and make mistakes, especially early on, because I think you learn so much from doing something. And like once you've shot something, analyze it yourself, look at your work and go, what worked with this, what didn't, and how would I do this differently knowing what I know now? And I think that's a really useful exercise, not to be self-critical, not to tear yourself apart, but just to look at what you've done and gone, right, how can I then improve that? what am I not happy with there, you know?
Yeah, no, that's healthy. I think if you don't do that, if you don't look at your own work in a critical lens, not too critical, but in an understanding critical, there's always things to improve on, and you will get better and better and better. And even nothing's perfect, right? Just being content.
Cut yourself some slack, but also look at stuff and go, right, I don't like that specific bit. Mm. How can I fix that? Or make that better next time I'm faced with that situation. It's learning, isn't it? It's all learning and growth.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, yeah, Ash, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you? What films are currently out there, on the circuit or coming up soon that you're a part of? How can people keep up to date?
Yeah, so best place is Instagram, at Ash Connaughton DP. I'm relatively active on there. There's also LinkedIn. But post a bit less on there, more active on Instagram. In terms of stuff that is currently at festivals, there's a comedy short called Talking Rubbish. There's Daniel's Room, which is a short horror. There is another comedy short called No Worries If Not, which is coming to the end of its festival run now, I think. God, what else have I got that's at festivals at the moment? I'm just scrubbing through to make sure I've not forgotten anything that's currently in festivals. I've got a short film called Quiet that's in post at the moment that should be out later this year that we shot back in March with Luke Rollison and, why does her name? Philippa Dunn from Motherland. She was in it. And then I've also got a short called The Sound of Movement, which is currently wrapping up post and will be again out later this year. I've got a feature film called The House on Liddiman Street, which is a horror, really low budget horror. It was the feature I was shooting when I went to the premiere in London that night. So that's finished post now and should be out later this year. That was a really, really cool film to be part of. And then I've also got another short called Deadheading, which finished filming in August, and that's currently in post. And we're just finishing up the last couple of bits on post in that because we're trying to make the deadline for South by Southwest. So fingers crossed on that one, but you never really know with the festival game. It's, and maybe by the time this goes out, we'll have heard back and either got in or not got in. So
when is that date or when are you expecting
that? The deadline is, I think Tuesday. So,
oh wow!
I think we're literally wrapping up post tomorrow and submitting.
Wow, cutting it close,
really close. But I mean, you know, we finished filming in August, so we've been in post since we wrapped. And that's like with a full sound mix. That's color grade. That's the edit. That's
a
full soundtrack composed. So, you know, there's been a lot of work that's gone into it over the past month or so in post, and the post team have all done a fantastic job. So,
yeah, man. Well, wish you the best of luck with that. Thank you so much for your time. Everyone, follow Ash, and I hope to see you. I definitely will be seeing you at some of these local festivals as well. So I'll see you there.
I'm sure.
But yeah, thank you so much for your time, Ash. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, mate. It was lovely chatting to you.
Thank you.